Call to order the House Education Committee on for March 8, 2017. Okay, we're going to open up, we'll stay on schedule here. We'll open up the first bill, a public hearing on House Bill 2540, on 2108. Leith, if you want to read what it is, and then we'll call up the folks that are signed up.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2108 repeals Oregon Statute 330.035, which requires homeschooled students to be examined in grades 3, 5, 8, and 10, and dependent on the testing scores, may require the superintendent to order the child to return to school. This bill prohibits school districts from denying homeschool students opportunities to participate in interscholastic activities, which includes athletics, music, speech, and other related activities, requires homeschool students meet minimum academic standards and achieve a minimum score on a nationally normal standardized achievement test to participate in those activities, and it allows the school district to require the homeschooled students submit a portfolio of work samples to the district committee for review in order to determine the eligibility of the interscholastic activity.
Okay, fine, thank you. Okay, we'll call Heather Church, Dr. Brian Ray, and Cindy Yoder for our first panel. And then after that, we've got Joyce Padilla, Peter Padilla, and Angela Davis. Okay, could you identify yourself for the record?
Chair Doherty and members of the House Education Committee, thank you for hearing my testimony regarding House Bill 2108. My name is Heather Church, and I am a homeschool mom, and I am also one of the board members of the OCHEN Network, the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network, and Polk Christian Home Educators. My husband and I have been home educating our children for over 18 years. Standardized testing for our three older children was not a concern because none of them had a learning delay. However, our youngest child has moderate dyslexia and is tutored in reading, so achieving a minimum score above the 15th percentile is always a concern at testing time. One of my roles with the OCHEN Network is taking phone calls from people in Oregon who have questions regarding home education in Oregon. And sometimes those calls come from parents of children with learning delays who have concerns about the testing, standardized testing. And specifically, their concerns are with regard to their children being able to achieve the minimum 15th percentile score on the standardized testing. Any homeschool parent with a child who scores within 5 to 10 points of the cutoff worries about this possibility. This is the greatest weakness of this current law, that parents of children with learning disabilities must divert their attention from doing what is most important for their child, and that is focusing on the area of weakness in order to concentrate on preparing their child to achieve a test score higher than the 15th percentile. And thereby, they're investing valuable teaching time and resources to alleviate a short-term threat rather than focusing on the long-term goal. This damages the child's progress and creates unhealthy worry and anxiety for both the parents and the child. Another problem with the current law is that education service districts are harming homeschooled children with disabilities by misapplying the law. In particular, the Lane and Lynn Benton Lincoln ESDs require parents to get permission from the local school district in order to utilize the existing provisions that are intended for protecting those children with disabilities, learning disabilities. The provisions allow parents to educate children with learning disabilities using a privately developed plan, also known as a PDP, which is the homeschool equivalent of the public school IEP. However, the misrepresentation of this law by the ESDs forces parents to have their child evaluated by the local school district to determine if the child has a disability before allowing the parent to use the administrative rules meant to help these students. There is no specific authorization in any part of the law for ESDs to require this evaluation by the school district. However, parents are not allowed to use the PDP without first having the evaluation by the school district, which essentially blocks their access to the use of the PDP without the school district's permission. So due to these weaknesses in the current law, I respectfully ask for your support of House Bill 2108.
Okay, thank you.
Next. Hello, I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Cindy Yoder. I am very new to this. I'm just going to speak from the heart. I'm a grandmother. I homeschooled all five of my sons all the way through their education. Not something that I had ever planned on doing, but every year I felt called to do it for just one more year. All five of my sons are upstanding citizens, serving in the military, working. We've just never had any trouble with them, and I truly believe that it was because I was allowed to teach them the things that I felt like would be important to them. I was not against testing until just recently, reading and educating myself on this. Again, my children are all grown and in their 20s. I have had problems with Common Core. I've heard nothing good about Common Core. I've done some study on it myself, and I believe that I have to get behind this bill to repeal the testing because the testing would be based on Common Core. I have a dear friend who is highly educated. I work with her mom, who is vice president of a large company here in Salem. She's a teacher, this younger friend, and she has pulled out of her job teaching and has since pulled her two children out of the public school system. When I asked her why, she said it was because of Common Core. She is now homeschooling her children. It's a homogenized system that is federally mandated all over the country, which is always a bad idea in most cases. It gives the testers an artificial disadvantage when taking the test. It's a one-size-fits-all. One of the pleasures that I had in homeschooling my children was choosing curriculum that I felt was best for that child. You may think when you have five sons that they're all the same, but they're very, very different. I had my first two were identical twins. Even they needed a different approach, especially in the elementary years for education. I was able to cater somewhat to their learning styles in the early years, and I was able to pick and choose curriculums that I found valuable. There's so many good choices out there now. Some are new and some are old and have stood the test of time. If I had been forced to teach all five of my children under the same rules, it would have been a fiasco. It would have been a disaster. One of my boys was on the floor sliding around doing a lot of touch and a lot of movement as he learned, and he is one of my brightest boys and is working in the healthcare field. I don't really, really have anything else to say. I just I feel passionate that maybe all of you can relate to something in your history where you just soon would have liked to forget something that you've learned in the past. And how would you feel if you had to be tested on something that you really didn't want to learn in the first place?
Hello, my name is Brian Ray. Thank you for allowing me to address you on this. I have a PhD from Oregon State University, a teaching certificate in Oregon, and I'm a former public school, private school teacher, former professor at the university, undergraduate levels. I've been studying homeschooling for about 33 years. I've talked to some of you before, but not some of you ever. There are several reasons why I think that this 2108 is an excellent idea. First of all, a lot of us like to say that we base our thinking on empirical evidence. Well, I need to get right on the table. There is no empirical evidence anywhere that there's even a correlation between state control of homeschooling and children's academic achievement. I've done two nationwide studies. We divided up the 50 states into level of control. Found zero correlation. And any of you know some research logic, there has to be at least a correlation to talk about cause and effect. There is no correlation. Secondly, in other words, in states where there's no homeschool law, if you don't put your children in public schools, the public schools have no control or authority, versus states like New York where there's a lot of state control, no difference in the test scores. Secondly, homeschool students in Oregon and nationwide consistently in study after study, some of which I've done, and a lot of doctoral students and others have done these studies, are scoring 15 to 30 percentile points above the national average. It's not because they're required to be tested. It has nothing to do with that. It's a lot of other things that we could get into in terms of educational theory, some of which this lady just mentioned, customization, individualization, one-on-one, tutoring, mentoring, mastery learning, all these things. So that's why they're doing well. And along those lines, even in the world of professional education, I think a lot of you know there's huge debate over the value of tests, whether they should be used, not used, why use them, why not use them. Generally speaking, and I've taught graduate level courses on testing and measurement, that's one of my specialties, they're set up to basically drive a curriculum, and they're set up to find out whether a particular district is, you know, kind of like doing what it's supposed to be doing because it's tax funded. None of those apply to home education. And in fact, those kinds of standards are not applied to Roman Catholic schools, Lutheran schools, New Age private schools, agnostic schools, Jewish schools, which brings me to the third reason. And that's, it's not done in Oregon. This bill would finally make a law related to homeschooling fair and equitable. I've never heard of anybody promoting a law that says if a child in public school falls below the 15th percentile, he might be remanded someday to private school or homeschooling, ever. The law in Oregon is inequitable. It's unjust. The laws in Oregon do not control Roman Catholic schools, Lutheran schools, New Age, Waldorf, Montessori. They don't control those schools. They're not receiving tax funding, and they're not held to those kinds of regulations. Try to speed up here. I'm not sure how much time I have. Fourth reason is that I've already mentioned this one, that there's a lot of debate about testing. And I think what's really important to know is that testing drives what people do. And there's no reason to drive what homeschool teachers do with their children, because again, they're not public schools. Mm-hmm. I want to toss out something that might not be brought up at all, but there is a misleading allegation that's going around in the United States, and I follow this very carefully. It might pop up, it might not, so it's, you know, kind of risky to mention it, but there's an allegation that somehow homeschooling is related to abuse and child fatalities. And some people try to use homeschool regulation laws to try to catch parents before they do something bad. First of all, there's no evidence for that, research-wise. And secondly, it's very likely you'll be contacted by some of these people. So if you have questions about the research, please contact me. Their research, well, they don't have research actually, but the evidence they have in an article, they even say there's no significant difference in rates of abuse. So that's something to be real careful about, cautious about, because often they'll show up, often from another state, to talk about that. Finally, I'll just wrap it up. There are a few other I would call minor reasons because they're not as philosophical and educationally based, but homeschool families are saving Oregon taxpayers now bare minimum $366 million per year of taxpayer dollars, bare minimum. If the ESDs no longer had to watch out and try to control or regulate homeschoolers, the state would save even more money. And third, statistically speaking, if more children were homeschooled, you would have even more Oregonian children with higher test scores, which would be another reason to just allow homeschoolers to be free like they are in at least, totally free, like they are in at least 11 other states in America where the scores are just as high, the social skills are just as good, and the research says there's no difference in terms of control versus academic achievement. So I'll have a paper for all of you and I'll hand them out later. Thank you.
Okay, fine, thank you. Are there any questions of this panelist? Okay, I guess one question I have, the half of the bill deals with interscholastic activities. Half of the bill deals with sports and interscholastic activities, and it still requires that they take tests if they want to participate in interscholastic activities. So you hadn't addressed that, so I didn't know if...
Yeah, I don't feel competent to address that aspect of the bill.
Pardon?
I don't have enough knowledge to address that aspect of the bill. I think there will probably be somebody else here who could talk about that.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay, thank you so much. Okay, next we have Joyce Padilla, Peter Padilla, and Angela Davis. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Joyce. I'm Joyce Padilla, and I'm a mother of seven sons. I've homeschooled all of our sons from the get-go. Our oldest is 33. Our youngest is 16, a junior in high school. He has 1 year before he graduates and he completes his education. My husband and I have also served on the state wide homeschool board, Ocean Network, which has brought this board, bill before you. So this bill, HB 2108, is a bill to remove notification and testing requirements for homeschoolers. In 1985, homeschoolers in Oregon began schooling under our very first homeschool law. And under this law, we were required to annually notify and to test annually. In 1999, a new law was put in place, which remains in place today. And under the 1999 law, annual notification moved to a one-time notification, and testing moved from an annual testing to testing at the 3rd, 5th, 8th, and 10th grades. Now, over the past 30 years, homeschoolers have set records in the state of Oregon and around the nation. Study after study has shown that as an educational method, home education works. Homeschool students, on average, as Dr. Brian Ray just said, score 20 to 30 percentile points above public school students and test an average of 2 grade levels above their age level. This holds true in states where testing is mandated by the state as well as in states where testing is voluntary. My point, state regulation is not what produces academic excellence for home-educated students. Homeschool students excel because parents have assumed the responsibility of the education of their children, and we take this very seriously. I'm not opposed to testing. I am opposed to state-mandated testing upon families. I'm opposed to the state using testing as a tool to determine who can and cannot homeschool. Under the 1999 law, test scores may or may not be requested by the ESD, the Educational Service Districts. Less than 15% of the ESDs request test scores from homeschoolers. Why? Perhaps it's because they know that homeschoolers have an excellent track record. What this means is that about 85 to 90% of homeschoolers are taking state-mandated tests for no bureaucratic reason under the current law. Parents should be able to spend their time, their money, and the resources to test their children in the manner of their choosing, not according to a one-size-fit-all schedule or method. At present, homeschooling families are having tests administered to their children that are unbeneficial to the children and parents, only to fulfill the requirement of the law. I believe homeschoolers are doing well enough to be left alone. It's time the state recognizes us for who we are as private home educators, and as such, treat us as a private entity. As you well know, private schools in Oregon are independent, as Dr. Bray also brought out. Private schools are not required to register with the state. No list of the students are sent to the state. No parent is required to tell the government that his or her child is enrolled in that private school. Private schools are not public schools. Private home education is not public education. Yet, as long as we have government oversight, that is notification and testing requirements, we are considered an entity of the public schools. We are not public educators, we are private home educators. And as such, we desire to be recognized as such. So I ask you to support House Bill 2108, removing notification and testing requirements for private home educators.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Peter Padilla. I serve as vice chairman of the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network, and we represent about 50 homeschool support groups around the state of Oregon. We have a mailing list of somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 households that we send publications to and are in communication with. Basically, I am not going to reiterate a lot of what has been said. Just to point out that Oregon has a history of a progressive nature in many aspects. And in about 1923, there was an incident that somewhat brought a little bit of a blight on that. And it was when the state wanted to mandate that all children be educated in the government public classrooms. And basically there was an organization, the Roman Catholic Society of Sisters, that had objections to that. And basically were taken to court, which ended up going all the way to the Supreme Court, which is Pierce versus the Society of Sisters. And in that, basically in that case, the Supreme Court made the ruling that that it was the fundamental theory of liberty upon which all governments of this union repose exclude the general power of the state to standardize its children by forcing them to accept instruction from public teachers only. The child is not the mere creation of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right and high duty to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations. The Supreme Court basically has, upon that ruling, basically, and in the 80s, you know, many of the states were confronted with that when giving more liberty to the homeschool movement. As far as private schools, in the state of Oregon, that after 1925, in that ruling, there was great liberty in the aspect of private schools. And as Joyce pointed out, the state of Oregon recognizes the independence of private schools. No private schools are required to register in the state of Oregon. No list of students is sent to the state. No parent is required to tell the government schools that it has that his or her children are enrolled in that private school. Private schools are not public schools. Homeschools are not public schools either. Just as private schools in Oregon are not regulated, homeschools in Oregon should not be regulated either. The superintendent of public instruction and the Department of Ed should have jurisdiction over public schools, not private schools or homeschools. In addressing your issue of the interscholastic, basically we recognize that if children participate in a public school activity, then they need to step up to those requirements and right. be held accountable to those.
Right, and if you will look in your House Bill 2108, we do address that in the bill, mm-hmm. and it does say that a school district may not deny a homeschooled student the opportunity to participate in interscholastic activities if the homeschooled student fulfills all the following conditions, and it lays it out.
Right.
So we have addressed that.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Next.
Good afternoon. My name is Angela Davis, and I don't disagree with anything that has been said prior to my testimony for two-thirds of the students that I'm going to leave to them to address. I would like to bring to your attention the remaining third. I'm a high school teacher. I've worked in alternative education for about 16, 17 years. Two school districts in Oregon have hired me to come in and look at their data to find students that are not in school. It's always been important in that effort to determine whether or not those school districts are looking at students who are registered to homeschool and are not in school, in other words, not submitting their state test results, or whether they just want to focus on students that are not in school and not registered to homeschool. So I do want to make that differentiation clear. What I've learned about the third that I'm talking about, well, let me tell you about the other two-thirds first. About a third of families choose to homeschool their child for religious or academic reasons. Some of the reasons given today. They want to have control over the curriculum. They have other priorities. Maybe they live on a farm. They want to teach their kids agriculture. Most of those students do very well. The other third are students whose parents just feel like they could do a better job because they know the child better. Maybe the child has a certain learning style or maybe the child is a dancer and aspires to go on to dancing, and the parent feels that he or she can do a fantastic job educating that child. I generally agree. Now let me tell you about the other third. In my experience, I want to share three stories with you because this represents the other third. In working for school districts to find out-of-school youth, one of the young men that I met was living in a camp trailer that was rented to him. He was living with another young homeless male. When he climbed the stairs to meet me in a classroom, he could not breathe because his asthma was so severe that he was having a chronic asthma attack. So I, of course, had to immediately seek medical attention for this young man. Through working with him for several months, I also learned that he did not have adequate supplies of food, clothing, laundry, transportation, and really had almost no supervision. It was, to me, it was fantastic to see him transition into a program where he had more accountability and his family had more accountability. As a result, his family actually left Portland and moved to the school district where he was living, and he started to get some services. Let me tell you about another family that I chose to adopt 1 year when I was working with homeschooling families. This family was living in a camp trailer at a county campground. There was one light. That was the light provided by the county campground. When it flooded, they had to get in their car and drive to the laundromat, where they slept all night in wet sleeping bags in their car. When I took Christmas gifts out to this family, they immediately reported to me a rape that they had been waiting for me to arrive to report, because they just didn't feel like they had anybody else they could reach out to. I then helped them connect with the services that could provide them what they needed to deal with the rape and the perpetrator who was living in the same campground. The third story that I want to share with you is a young lady who's a refugee from another country. When I met her after she had been homeschooled, she had a variety of different disabilities that had really impeded her learning for quite a while. It is very, very difficult for these young folks when they come to high school at the end of their homeschooling career to find that they are years short of ever passing any of the essential skills or any of the tests required for screening for college entrance. And I even mean placement in a community college remedial program. It is heartbreak for these kids. So what I really want to tell you is that what Dr. Ray was right. These tests are a bit of a method to close a gap. The question that's been, that's been presented to you is, how big is the gap? It's really not that big when you see all of these very effective homeschooling families coming forward to say, we don't need testing, we're doing a great job. We're doing everything that homeschooling is supposed to be. We're customizing the curriculum to our children. We're adapting the learning styles to our children's needs. We're giving them fantastic experiences that they wouldn't have in school. I wholeheartedly agree with that. The only part that I don't agree with is the idea that students, our youth, our most at-risk youth, could completely fall off of every single solitary list that exists that would potentially enable them to be identified. And that is how I have identified these young folks, is by working with ESDs in two ESD service areas with that list to identify those kids. The testing method really only got at those kids that were at risk. You know, if there was an eighth grader who hadn't tested and I called the mom and said, hey, how's it going? Oh, things are really rough. We'll get her tested within a year. Fantastic. Well, maybe we'll talk to you in a year. But for the parents who I called, who were facing terrible, terrible life circumstances, or these kids were living in these very, very difficult life circumstances, honestly, I never got the impression from those families that they regretted or somehow resented the school district showing up and saying, we want to help. I'm open to question. I have researched this thoroughly in printed articles, as well as, like I said, worked firsthand with schools and students and families in two school districts in two ESD regions.
Okay. Okay, fine. Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Yes, Representative McLean.
I don't know if it's really a question, but I just want to make it clear what you are in favor of. What you are in favor of is maintaining the notification and maintaining requirements for some testing as appropriate for student level, you know, review.
Regarding the bill, that is my position, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Those are all the people that we have signed up for the bill.
I have also brought four kinds of education I'd like to leave for each of the committee members.
Take that to the assistant.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, so with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2108 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2548. Letha, if you could read the summary, please.
Yeah. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2543 removes the 11% cap on the district's weighted average daily membership for calculations of the state school fund for special education or children with disabilities, and there is a subsequent referral to revenue on this bill.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hack.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me here today to talk with you about House Bill 2543. I bring this to you. I know that we're in a revenue crunch, so to speak, or a budget issues, and this will probably have a very large fiscal. However, I think it is greatly important that we bring this to light and begin to have some discussions about it. So I appreciate Chair Doherty's willingness to hear this very important issue. So special education funding is capped at 11% in our districts. What that means is if a district has more than 11% of its student population requiring special education services, they don't get any additional dollars. Mm-hmm. With the addition of open enrollment, I think that this is an issue that at some point needs to be addressed. With school districts that do a great job with their special ed students, oftentimes now, parents choose to move their kids to a district that's known for providing great special ed services, and they can with open enrollment. And why not? The problem with that is then a district is saddled with costs that they incur by providing those services, and we certainly wouldn't want to penalize a district because they're doing great work providing special education services. So as costs go up, as we have more students on the spectrum now in the state of Oregon than we have ever had in the history, we have a responsibility to make sure that we're having these conversations. Now, in all fairness, there is some additional funds that a district can ask for in addition to the $11,000. So they can request additional funding for high-cost students that cover costs over $30,000. They can get a certain percentage of the cost that's above the $30,000 that goes back to the base cost for students. They never get the entire cost paid, but they can get a portion of that. It depends on the amount of the state school fund, and there's a whole formula for that. After talking with several districts, it's oftentimes they get a very, very small amount of that. And that might be something that we can look at in the shorter term versus the long-term conversation of actually looking at fixing the 11%. So it may be that while we can't deal with the 11% issue right now, we might be able to look at what we do on the small amounts of money that we do give back based on the costs that go over $30,000. Again, I just hate to see us take a district who has done excellent work and underfund them and penalize them for the fact that they're doing great work. And these are our most vulnerable and our most needy kids that need the most in services. So I didn't bring a big panel today because I know that the possibility of this actually happening this session is probably pretty moot. But at the same time, it is important. And I think that we have to begin to have conversations about what we might do in the future. So again, I want to thank Chair Doherty for agreeing to hear it for those very reasons. Because if we don't talk about it and we don't bring it to the forefront, nothing's ever going to change. So with that, I won't take up any more of your time. But if you have any questions or you want to discuss it any further, I'm happy to do that. But it's an important issue.
It is. Okay. Any questions of Representative Hack? Representative McClain.
Representative Hack, you're not including the high-risk medical, the ones that have $30,000 or more of cost. These are just the regular special ed classifications.
So special ed classifications, they are Chair Doherty, sorry, Representative McClain. So they are capped at the 11%, and districts can request funding if they go over the 30%. But that funding, they never get the entire cost paid for what's over the 30. They get a small portion of that, and then that's based on what the state school fund, mm-hmm. the total state school fund, and there's a calculation for that that, I'll be honest, goes above my head. Mm-hmm. But in my conversation with school districts, oftentimes doesn't come near to covering. I mean, if they have, let's say they're at 15% and some of those kids have medical necessities that you're talking about, oftentimes they don't come anywhere near covering those additional costs.
Can I just follow? Last year I had a bill that dealt with, you know, going from 40% up to 80% of covering the cost of those students. And so we at least doubled the cost for the special fragile students. They're above the $30,000, mm-hmm. you know, sort of threshold. But I agree that this is an important area and something that I hope we can look at in the future. But I think that category, because of the way the formula works, is a little bit different than the rest of the folks you're talking about.
Chair Doherty, Representative McClain, it is. They put those dollars back into that. Districts kind of categorize it all under that special ed category in the conversations that I had. But I think it is. There is some differences there, but again, it goes back to the districts that do a great job. I mean, I would want my son or daughter there. Mm-hmm. And with open enrollment, they have every reason and every opportunity to do so. Mm-hmm. And a district certainly shouldn't be penalized for doing a good job.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Lyle. I'm pointing at you.
Chair Doherty, Representative Hack. Thank you for bringing this. I had no idea. This was kind of a revelation to me. I'm a little confused. The language on, I think it's the first page, at line 24, 25, that takes out the which may not exceed the 11%, that language,
yes.
says without review and approval by the Department of Education. What happens currently if you, can you get more money if you go over that 11%?
Chair Doherty, Representative Vile, I think that's referring to the addition. If it goes over the $30,000, then
okay.
they can kick in, and that has to do with the state school fund and the formula that they have.
Follow up?
We're saying pay them per student for the amount of special ed students that they have. So if they have 15% of their population in special ed students, allocate the funds for the 15%. Don't cap it at 11 if you have 20%. Then give them the 20%.
You read my mind. That was the question I was going to ask. Thanks.
Senator Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I had two questions that if you don't know the answer to is fine, but maybe for the ongoing conversations, because I also think that this is an important topic. How many school districts right now do you believe are at the 11%? Mm-hmm. How many out of the 199 school districts, how many are actually capped at 11%, have met that cap? And then the follow-on question would be, if we did get rid of this cap, given the formulas and everything else, what would we realistically assume the top tier might be in terms of, would it be 20% or 25%? Would not be a cap, but rather a figure that we would actually anticipate given the increase of special needs students into schools and the cost thereof. Make sense?
Yep, Chair Doherty and Representative Evans, we have those numbers up in the office. I'm happy to get those for you. I didn't bring
Great.
Them down.
Thank you.
And as far as looking at what those numbers might look like, I think that's where, in all honesty, I would love to see us put together a work group and say, why is it that, you know, how many do we have on the spectrum now versus how many we had 10 years ago? I think that we would find it's astronomical. And there's a lot of different drivers around that. But I think those projections would drive what we could guess we would have or what we would anticipate we would have in the future. I know there's another bill on the Senate side that is very, very similar to this, and I think they tried to anticipate that, which is where the fiscal came from, mm-hmm. and the fiscal was
rather large.
Any other questions, Representative Hernandez?
This is more of a comment. For my school district, the Reynolds School District, we have a little bit above a 15%, and only get reimbursed for that 11%. And that did create many problems for us, as we needed to cut other things to fully fund, because we do have to fund the special ed. And my question is regarding like maintenance of effort. What happens when we remove this cap and school districts that see a decrease or a big decrease in special ed students and don't get that reimbursement yet still have to meet that budget requirement or expenditure, if you will?
Chair Doherty and Representative Hernandez, you know, that is a good question. And I think that's probably where you have to look to your ESDs for services, shared services, I would think, especially our small districts. When you talk about behavioral specialists, and we're looking now at social workers and possibly having some of those folks come from, and back in the day we used to do some of that. So I would say that the maintenance of effort would have, you know, I'd look at it that way, probably. You know, and that's just off the top of my head. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that are smarter than I am that understand that better than I do. But if I were to take a stab at that, that's what I would say.
Yeah, so we have a few. Well, you know, not that I'm older than dirt, but I am. And actually, the first year I taught back in 1974 was one of the first years that the 94 and 196 had passed at the federal level. And I remember back at that time going through and saying, the federal government saying that they would reimburse at probably 40 or 45% the cost for special ed children that were now being mainstreamed into the public schools. And I think even way back then, the cap was 11%, and so that the state would reimburse at 11%, you know, that your entire school population would up to 11% of special needs kids, and that has changed quite a bit. So it's very timely, it's very relevant, but it's it is also very expensive, and most districts are over the 11%. They just get the reimbursement for 11%. They pay much more. So.
Chair Doherty, that's a great point. And when we did the research, that's true. We found most districts were. And back then, most districts hadn't even come close to 11%.
No.
But that goes back to the conversation that Representative Evans brought up, and that's the questions. How, you know, it goes back to how many do we have on the spectrum? What can we anticipate having? Which I think we need to do some work on and have some forethought down the line.
Yeah. And if you could talk, say, homogeneous disabilities, back then there were pretty much one or two disabilities, and that was pretty much it. But it's got much better. So anyway, Representative McLean.
Just to add to your list of statistics, I mean, even on the high fragile end group that I worked on last year, in the two school districts that I have in my part of the district, they were able to put $1 million back into the regular classroom dollars because of that 40% that we increased on the fragile kids. Mm-hmm. That was in Forest Grove. In Hillsboro, it was almost $750,000. Yeah. So, I mean, they're big dollars. Now, those are the high-end fragile kids. But still, again, as you point out, the spectrum, we know more about the spectrum. We know how to distinguish on the spectrum more, and there's more issues. Mm-hmm. So I hope that we all can work on this together in the future.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Representative Hack.
Thank you.
Okay, we have four people signed up for this. How about Soren Metzger and Richard Donovan, and then Morgan Allen and Sean Reinhart?
She
made that point. And actually, the last two, we can have you guys go together. Okay. I like your time, Mr. Donovan.
Madam Chairman, Richard Donovan on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. Thank you very much for letting me testify on House Bill 2543. And first, I also want to thank Representative Hack, who I think just slipped out of the room, for teeing up this conversation. She's done a great job, and she's brought the right message. You know, OSBA stands very firmly for the proposition of serving all kids, of serving students based upon their needs. And as she said, these are some of the most vulnerable, most needy kids in Oregon today. Unfortunately, I've signed up to testify in opposition to the bill only because of the cost. The policy of the bill is probably the right policy. I've have informal kind of done my back of my legislative notebook calculations and understand that it would cost. It would bring about 13,000 additional weights into the state school funding formula. That'd be about between $90 and $100 million a year in new costs. And we are for giving students what they need. We're for treating students appropriately and serving their needs. But it is that balancing act that continues throughout all these bills this session in terms of funding school and education underfunding generally. And we can't support a bill that would thin the soup, to use the LFO term, and fund some kids at the expense of others, unfortunately, some students. I know that our other folks that are going to follow me are going to speak specifics, so I will, just not taking any more time, will be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Metzger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me here. I'm Soren Metzger. I'm here today on behalf of the 21,000 school support personnel who are represented by the Oregon School Employees Association. We're here today respectfully in opposition of House Bill 2543 for similar reasons. I think you all have pretty much covered it. And I would just add that, you know, though OSCA agrees with fully funding special education by increasing the amount in the state school fund, beyond maintenance of effort levels, increasing the current 11% funding cap, and also fully funding the individual with Disabilities Education Act up to 40%, I'm afraid that there may be some unintended consequences with House Bill 2543. That being said, I do appreciate the serious look this legislative body and chair, this committee, is taking investing in Oregon's most vulnerable student population, and I look forward to working with all of you to find a solution. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of the panel? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Morgan Allen and Sean Reinhart, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members of the committee, Morgan Allen, on behalf of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, just very briefly echo some of the sentiments you heard from the previous folks. Really appreciate Representative Hack teeing up this topic. It's an important one. And as Mr. Donovan said, another way to look at this is if you made this change, it would be as if about 13,000 kids moved into the state. It adds about 13,000 weights to the formula. You'd need to add approximately $200 million a biennium to the state school fund to have a revenue neutral impact on all the other weights in the formula. So it is quite costly. But, you know, the important thing, and Representative McLean talked a little bit about this, is really the question about the high-cost disability students. The legislature last biennium doubled that amount. But still, for example, if you have a school district and you have a student that costs, let's say, $100,000 a year to educate, even with the high-cost disability fund and the double weighting, a school district would only get about $70,000 from those sources to pay for that student. So you can see, particularly for our smaller districts or our rural districts, if you have, you know, three or four or five high-cost disability students in your district, that can add up to six figures quite quickly, and there's no other funding sources for that. So, again, really appreciate the conversation, looking at things like the cap and the high-cost disability fund, but just understanding that if we were to make changes like this, we would have to significantly increase the money that goes into the state school fund to have a net neutral impact on the other weights in the formula.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Mr. Reinhart.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, thanks for hearing my testimony. My name is Sean Reinhart. I'm Executive Director of Special Programs for Benefine Schools. And the first thing I want to say is I am all in favor of increased resources for our students with disabilities in the state of Oregon. It's the work that I do every day, and there's plenty of ways that we could make those dollars go towards greater education for them. Under the current version of this bill, I am going to come out against it for the reason that our previous speakers have said in terms of with no additional funding, what would happen is we would just spread the cost pool and we in our district, Ben Lapine, would probably see a decrease in funding for students. I have a story to tell. Back in 2008-2009, the Ben Lapine schools, we identified that 14.6% of our students were identified as students with disabilities and were on IEPs. That same year, we implemented a response to intervention system and other strategies. In that system, we ensured great academic, core academic instruction. We were, implemented systematic interventions for students that were struggling academically and behaviorally. And the result is that we saw a sharp decline in enrollment in special education. And for 2 years in a row, we've now held steady at 10.8% students with disability. The reason that we're sustaining that is because it's a direct result of improved instruction and curriculum in the classroom, improved and systematic interventions, data-based decision-making, a laser focus on professional learning and best practices. We've restructured departments, created new roles to support the ongoing work of RTI. We've hired teachers and administrators specifically to help implement this system, and the RTI is a framework by which all programs and initiatives are applied. So, in other words, we created a whole system around better teaching and better instruction. That said, you know, without additional funding, we would be unfairly penalized for the hard work that we've done to decrease our enrollment in special education. And it would also de-incentivize this type of work, which, by the way, the work was initiated through the State Professional Development Grant, the Oregon RTI Project, and it was, and that's one of the main hallmarks of the professional development grant that's administered through via ODE, and it was their support and their work that helped our create our systems that allowed us to do this. But it would de-incentivize that kind of work, and I think that what we would see is that if districts aren't at 13% or 14%, they would be very soon, as soon as this type of bill is passed. That said, I know there are higher costs associated with educating students with disabilities, and I do applaud efforts. For example, increasing the high-cost grant has been a great benefit for Ben Lapine schools. Those types of monies that target very specific cost drivers have been a huge benefit for us. And we all know that our cost drivers aren't the students that have high incidence disabilities. It's those students that present with low incidence disabilities, those that cost a lot to educate. And so grants like that are very helpful for us, and the increase in that has been a benefit. And as Mr. Allen said, any further increases in that or any type of targeted funding like that would be a great benefit, and those are the types of programs I think would benefit the kids the most. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of this panelist?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, that's all we have signed up for House Bill 2543. Anyone else want to speak on it? Okay, if not, we close the public hearing on House Bill 2543. And we're going to open up a public hearing to hear amendments on House Bill 2688. Representative Evans.
Pardon?
Yeah, if you want to introduce the bill.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2688 establishes the Oregon Quality Education Model Modernization Task Force for the purpose of evaluating current standards for staffing, technology, and transportation, evaluating workforce requirements and opportunities for private sector investments. There's a dash one amendment available online. The amendment repeals the language establishing the Oregon Quality Education Model Modernization Task Force to create such task force for the purpose of evaluating the comprehensiveness of the determinations made by the Quality Education Commission, utilizes the task force to evaluate the comprehensiveness of the model and consider student needs in relation to staffing. There is a fiscal impact statement which has been issued online. Revenue impact statement issues no impact. There's a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means, and we previously heard this on February 22nd, 2017.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Evans. I represent House District 20 in the Oregon Legislature, consisting of Monmouth, Independence, West Salem, South Salem, arguably one of the prettiest districts in the state.
people get upset when I say it is the prettiest.
Representative Johnson may disagree with you.
Yes. Well, that's okay. In the beginning, there was a plan. And then the plan became a legislative concept, and then the legislative concept became a bill, and then friends saw the bill and made suggestions. We are here today talking about Amendment 1 to this bill. And quite frankly, I think the amendment does a lot of good in explaining what the intent was. The intent of this approach, the intent of this concept, is to modernize the quality education model in ways that may not have been done previously, with an eye toward how life and culture has changed over the last 20 years in terms of what kinds of supports are necessary, what kinds of things are going on in the school. The major changes, it's kind of a gut and stuff, but if you actually take it line by line by line, there's only a couple of real changes. The real changes are focused on taking out the 80, 90, 100, 103% of the budget. The goal of that, quite frankly, was to try and come up with a formula that could say, all right, a school is X amount of dollars for full funding of the quality education model with 3% on top of that for local tailored education and workforce development. That got a little bit gummy in terms of legislative language, so we took that part out. Focusing on the modernization is the change of this amendment, and long term, the goal is to take the baseline that we develop and then perhaps use that as a discussion point for local tailoring. But that's, again, another bill, another day. This particular amendment simply clarifies the language, focuses on what we're trying to do in terms of some of the aspects that I believe are a little bit different than they originally were when the program was first started. And that's all there is to it.
Okay, any questions of Representative Evans? Okay, I appreciate you going through and making things a little clearer, a little simpler, and the idea of updating, because I know that we did get a fiscal on this, and the fiscal is, I mean, we hate to say in our business, not large, but it was anywhere from $10,000 to $74,000, depending upon
right.
How much they were going to go through and delve into the issue.
Right.
So so it was good. I'm glad you brought these clarifications.
And I'm grateful for the assistance of getting in here, too, as well. We had a lot of conversations, and I think it's a better bill.
Yeah, it's been around for a long time, so needs to upgrade. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you, Representative Evans. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2688 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2649.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2649 requires the State Board of Education to adopt by rule process for students or other members of the public to submit to the Department of Education a complaint alleging that a school district policy does not comply or was in violation of something. It requires the State Board of Education adopt rules related to standards for ODE to use in order to determine whether the district complies with the requirements and develop a process for ODE to review and investigate such complaints. And it requires the complainant notify the school where the reported act of harassment, intimidation, or bullying occurred and allow the district an opportunity to respond to the complaint. It does require the Department of Education to document information about the person whom each act of harassment was taken against, including their race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, national origin, and disability, becomes operative on July 1st, 2018.
Okay, fine. Thank you. For the record, I'm State Representative Margaret Doherty. I represent Tigard in Southwest Portland, and I'm here today just to speak in favor of House Bill 2649. This was actually a bill that was brought up last session, and being the shorter session, it didn't have a lot of time or enough time to be vetted. But as an educator, I know how important it is that everything we do to keep children safe. And as bullying continues to be the pervasive issue facing our children in schools, Oregon really needs to do more to make sure that the school climate is safe and that inclusive and that it's very inclusive for all of our vulnerable students. House Bill 2649 is a step towards addressing the very important issue in our school, and that's bullying. In House Bill 2649 would allow Oregon to collect important information about our students who experience bullying, particularly students who are targeted for their status in a protected class. This data is important because it will allow us to better understand bullying and harassment issues facing the districts across Oregon. Additionally, this bill will provide the opportunity for students and parents to ensure that districts are fully implementing district policy by creating an appellate process through the Oregon Department of Education. This legislation is a modest attempt to address a very serious issue in our schools, and I urge your support. And I'm open for questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Doherty?
I have one.
Representative McLean.
Representative Doherty, can you just give me what's the difference between the status quo reporting and this reporting?
I think Representative McLean, Vice Chair Wilson, I think what we have right now is that there currently is no, from what we understand, no rule or law that says that if a parent does not feel that they're dealing with a bullying situation, there's no appellate decision. There's no recourse for the parent to say, we don't believe that the school district is fulfilling what their policy is. And we also have our sponsor, Representative Power. So that's basically what the difference is.
Question from Representative Vial.
Chair Wilson, Representative Doherty, Representative Power, I'm wondering if you've sensed what the cost to school districts to comply with the additional, and maybe even the Department of Education for that matter, with the additional time that would be spent in making sure that this was complied with.
Okay, Vice Chair Wilson, Vice Chair or Representative Vial, no. Not yet. We live at the fiscal office.
Okay.
And we don't have that quite yet, so.
Thank you. Representative Power, would you like to testify?
I would love to. My apologies for being late.
Okay. Certainly.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Wilson, Vice Chair Hernandez, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Karen Power from House District 41, and I'm here today as a chief sponsor of House Bill 2649. We all know that children are our future and that their success is vital to our state's prosperity. In order for children to succeed, it is imperative that we curate healthy learning environments that facilitate this success. I'm extremely concerned with the high rate of bullying in our schools nationally. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, 1 in 3 students have experienced bullying or harassment in their designated learning environments. Oregon's Department of Education reported that in the 2015-2016 school year, there were over 8,400 incidents reported of students experiencing some type of bullying in their schools, ranging from threats, intimidation, battery, sexual battery, harassment, sexual harassment, and even kidnapping. The landscape of student harassment, particularly racial and religious minorities, has become increasingly bleak since the election of President Trump in November. Just yesterday, Lake Oswego High School students organized a walkout due to incidents of racist graffiti in their school bathrooms. Students are stepping up because they know this is wrong, and I agree. The innumerable negative effects that bullying has on our children.
Oh, my God, that is so scary.
What that is a fire alarm. We'll take our computers and go outside.
Recess and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2649. Well, now, where were we?
Talking about an organized walkout.
Representative Power, continue.
Okay. So just yesterday, Lake Oswego High School students organized a walkout due to incidents of racist graffiti in their school bathrooms. Students are stepping up because they know this is wrong, and I agree. The innumerable negative effects that bullying has on our children are hampering their ability to succeed in the classroom. The Center for Disease Control says that students who experience bullying are at risk for poor school performance, sleep difficulties, anxiety, depression, suicide, and other mental health and behavior problems. It's hard to go to school if you don't want to be there because someone's making your life miserable. Students who engage in bullying behavior are also at greater risk for mental health and behavior problems, as well as academic problems, substance abuse, and violent behavior later in adolescence. We have to intervene. We may not know what the best vehicle for curbing bullying is, but we must have an avenue for data collection. The federal government began collecting data about bullying in 2005, and it's time for Oregon to catch up. When my staff asked the Department of Education for the bullying stats included in my testimony and submitted to OLIS, they weren't sure that they collected that information. Let's change that.
To improve our graduation rates, attendance rates, and education outcomes, we have to make Oregon a place where school children want to be. Taking bullying seriously enough to collect data is a step in the right direction. Thank you, members of committee, for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Power. Do we have any questions? Representative Bile.
Chair Wilson, Representative Power, Representative Doherty, what are the consequences to a school district if they get a complaint on them and the DOE says, yep, it looks like that was a legitimate complaint? What happens then?
So I've helpfully pulled up the bill.
Yeah.
And I can't. My computer died.
Well, and currently, and this is in the summary, is that they don't have rules regulating the complaints alleging that a school district policy has been violated. And so what this bill is basically doing is to make sure that there's some sort of an avenue. If somebody believes that the school district policy has been violated, then they have an avenue to bring that to somebody's attention in ODE. Currently, there are no rules for that.
Follow up. So it would be simply a process by which a school district is made aware, hey, look, there's a problem. You're not following your own rules or your own. I'm a little bit confused.
Yeah, Chair Wilson and Representative Vile, and part of it is not only that, but it's also the idea of, nor do we right now track, and Representative Power brought this up, track the types of complaints that occur. And so this isn't necessarily a cleanup bill, but it's the idea of if somebody believes that the policy has been violated on bullying, can they appeal to the or do something with Oregon, with ODE? And if we track these, you know, let's track exactly what kind of bullying is going on and so forth, so school districts can hopefully deal with that.
And if I may add, Representative Vile, I think in the rulemaking process, the current parameters are within the bill as it presently stands, help to frame up how the school district would have an opportunity to receive a notification of that. I think further detail on how their response might be framed would probably come out during the rulemaking.
Appreciate that, and I think that's probably the case. I asked earlier, or maybe I didn't get the question out, harassment, bullying definition. Does the bill contain a definition for that?
Yes. It does, and it cross-references to existing state statute on that.
Yeah, I think there are already definitions of that.
Okay.
It's just this is more of an enforcement follow-up. What are they as opposed to the definitions of those? And I don't know for sure, but I can get back to you as to whether that is, they have definitions in here. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further for this panel? All right, seeing none.
I'll add really quickly. To her point, yes, the current definition cross-reference within the bill tracks back to ORS 339.351, which has the comprehensive definitions for cyberbullying, harassment, intimidation, or bullying, and protected classes.
Thank you, Representative Power.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hernandez.
And if I may add some context as well, the federal government does require every school district every 2 years to report data of bullying and harassment with desegregated information, but I don't believe that ODE tracks that information.
Yeah, so we're kind of tacking on to what the federal government already requires.
Okay, further? All right, seeing none, thank you very much. We appreciate that. Next up, we'll call Emily from Oregon Department of Education. Emily, if you'd come forward, please. Thank you.
Vice Chair Wilson, members of the committee, my name is Emily Nazarov, and I'm with the Oregon Department of Education. I'm one of the legislative coordinators, and I actually, one of my other responsibilities is handling the Division 22 complaint and appeal process, so I can answer your questions about what the law is currently around bullying, how we handle it, and what we currently track. So a few of the questions I heard were what currently happens. So there is a state law where the legislature has said that districts have to adopt anti-bullying and harassment policies. It's in our Division 22 OARs, and the Division 22 OARs have a complaint and appeal process to them. So if a parent or student files a complaint with their local district alleging bullying and harassment, they would go through their local complaint process, which is usually a three-step process. You start with your building level administrator, then you go to the superintendent, and then you go to the school board. They have the opportunity to appeal to the department currently, but that appeal is limited to this, to the very narrow question of, has the district adopted an anti-bullying and harassment policy that aligns with state law? We don't currently look at, did the district follow the policy, and did the student, was the student actually bullied or harassed? Unless the student is a member of a protected class, and then we would be able to investigate that under our civil rights investigation process. So that's currently how it works. The consequence to a district if they did get a complaint. If a complaint comes up through our Division 22 complaint and appeal process, if the Department of Education, I'll use a different example, so instructional time. If the Department of Education does an investigation and discovers that the district is out of compliance with the Division 22 standard around instructional time, then we issue a final order saying we found you're out of compliance. The district has to submit a plan to the department that details the corrective action they intend to do. We sign off on their corrective action plan, or we tell them to edit it. And then the district has until the beginning of the following school year to be back into compliance. If they're not back in compliance by the beginning of the following school year, or they don't get an extension from the deputy superintendent, then the deputy superintendent may withhold portions of state school fund from the district until the district is back in compliance. So that's how the enforcement mechanism works for Division 22 complaints and appeals. And then there were also questions about the data we track, and Representative Hernandez was correct. Districts do currently report information around bullying and harassment to the federal government. So it would not be a new reporting requirement for districts, it would be a new data collection for the department. We currently collect, as part of our discipline collection, we collect data related to non-sexual harassment and sexual harassment, but this only includes information about the perpetrator, such as the student ID number, race, ethnicity, and whether or not the perpetrator receives special education status. But we don't collect any information that tells us anything about the victim of the alleged bullying and harassment. So those are the questions that I heard I could respond to, but if you have any others, I'd be happy to help.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Emily? Okay, thank you very much for the information.
You.
Okay, we have three people signed up. How about Carla Hansen and Michelle Risher? Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, actually, you can just sit back because they're
all right. Perfect. Oh, that's okay. Thank you, Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Wilson, and to the members of the committee. I'm here in support of the HB 2649, enthusiastic support for this legislation. I hope you will support it as well. Every day a kid in school and
if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Oh, I apologize. I'm Carla Hansen, also known as Casey Hansen. I reside in Portland. I'm a longtime LGBT activist. Every day a kid in school and just about every Oregon school is bullied. Not every kid. There's incidents of bullying every day in Oregon schools. Most incidents are minor, and many are one-offs. But they won't be reported, and the victim will do whatever she or he can to avoid the bullying in the future. But even if this incident is fairly unremarkable, it does leave an impression. As a kid growing up in the late 60s and 70s, I was vaguely aware that I was different. But being the tomboy that I was, I just forced the issue and gravitated to what I wanted to do regardless of what the kids thought. I played the trumpet, played basketball with the boys, collected baseball cards, and built model cars. Well, I guess I was feisty and athletic enough to march through my elementary and high school years to be fairly successful. I was certainly not immune to sporadic incidents of bully behavior. Once I was cornered alone behind my elementary school and threatened by three boys. In junior high band, I was occasionally targeted by a lumbering drummer who delighted in stealing my sports books. These and a few other incidents are not noteworthy on their own. They were minor. I did not alter my behavior and I did not miss school. But nonetheless, those incidents are seared into my memory over 40 years later. This, to me, highlights two critical factors. One, how these confrontational incidents, even minor ones, can leave a lifelong memory, and two, how little we know what is happening with and to our kids. We certainly have progressed since the 70s, and Oregon has been a leader in addressing school bullying issues. And in particular, Oregon kids themselves have taken a lead in opposing bullying and supporting victims. Youth today as a generation have become much more accepting and understanding of individual differences. But despite the multi-generational civil advancement, the intimidation, the threats, and the bullying still continue, and our kids are still victimized daily. Just last night on Coin TV in Portland, they reported that in Grant High School, there was an incident of vandalism, which there was graffiti with that was very threatened and homophobic. While Grant High staff and students to endeavor to have a welcoming environment, this is what one of the kids said when she was interviewed. "Walking through the halls, you hear slurs and homophobic language all the time," she said. "I think for a lot of people who aren't queer, it came as a complete shock because they're not aware of how much this goes on a daily basis." Unfortunately, the adult world is setting a horrific standard and example for our youth. From bomb threats to over 130 Jewish centers and synagogues in the nation since January, one in Connecticut was reported this morning, to the murder of a Sikh man in Olathe, Kansas, to an elected Oregon official publicly and generically criticizing Multnomah and transgender youth, our poor behavior as adults seeps into our schools like an epidemic. As elected leaders and as activists before you, we must always endeavor to be that good and greater part of the adult world and work to counteract the insidious intimidation, the hate, and the violence that is both seen and unseen. Every day an Oregon school sees a kid that is bullied. We may not know it, but every one of them needs to know that we, as adults, are serious about protecting them. Thank you again for your consideration of this bill.
Okay, thank you, Michelle.
My name's Michelle Risher. I am also a longtime LGBT activist, beginning with a few years with the Houston GLBT Caucus, which is a nonpartisan organization to educate. I am obviously, I think, transgender. I have a certain unique perspective on all this. I'm also far more fortunate than many people. I'm closer to 64 than I am 63. I grew up in the late 50s and in 60s. I graduated high school in 71. I was aware back then of what people who were gay was. I spent up until I was 16 years old afraid if anybody found out how I felt in about this dissonance between physical and mental gender that I would get locked up. It was 1969. Guys in a locker room talking, they'd been to a drive-in, the B-movie was a Christine Jorgensen story, and I thought, my God, there's somebody else like me. And because it was prior to the internet, there was no educational material. I was fortunate in that I did endure some bullying because I wasn't aggressive. I tended to avoid conflict, both verbally and physically, and on occasion I ended up being forced to fight back, but nobody knew my secret. Had they known, I can only imagine just how badly that would have gone over. I'm fortunate in that between the summer of eighth grade and the end of my freshman year in high school, I grew, and all of a sudden I developed a lot of athletic prowess. I ended up in high school. I lettered in football, wrestling, and track. I co-captained the track and wrestling teams. I even wrestled a year at Ohio State. So I spent a lot of time always being afraid that somebody would catch on to it. But I saw bullying. I saw people being bullied, just your average kid that stuck out to them or seemed vulnerable when I was in high school. When I got to a certain point where I had some stature. I did everything I could to stop it. It was tough enough then. I have had, as an adult, I've had two episodes of severe major depression, and basically my life and the lives of other people that I've affected have in many cases been turned upside down by all this. So it's not just a single front issue. Bullies. Bullies have always abounded. They're there as kids, and certainly I have encountered them in the workplace, both at a management level and with my peers. This is beneficial to everybody, not just those who are in protected classes, but also the kids that are being randomly bullied, and the kids who were doing the bullying. As in the instance I was relating to Casey on the drive down here, there was a young man I went to high school with, and he was always bullying people, and he was always in fights. He had two older brothers. They behaved exactly the same. Come to find out later on that his father egged him on, and in fact, John got in a fight one time and he lost it. His father made him sleep on the porch that night outside in a winter in Ohio, which is not an inviting thing to do. What this sort of tracking enables to do is not only where the problems are, but repeated offenders. And if there is an environmental or home issue that is causing that, so it is prophylactic in those senses, and it can save a lot of kids. Also, the rates of suicide, especially among transgender kids, are incredibly high. Some people estimate 40% or higher. And I have done the research on that. Unfortunately, I walked out, got halfway up here, and realized I'd left my documentation. But there is no problem, and I'll be happy to provide the documentation. As far as cost goes, the issue that was brought up earlier on what it would cost the school board, I would argue that it is far more expensive to treat the adverse effects and outcomes caused by bullying in the school and by not taking proactive measures to it. It is mental health issues. It is issues of self-harm. It is suicide. It is counseling for all the other students that are involved in this whole process when somebody falls prey to it. So it is more or less in closing. This is beneficial to everybody up and down the line. And if it can save one kid, all the better.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions of the panelists?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much for telling your
story.
We
very
appreciate
much.
It very much. Okay, Nancy Willerall.
Thank you.
Doesn't sound well.
Thanks.
And we've got about 10 minutes before we need to close.
Great. Thank you. My name is Nancy Willard. I live in the Eugene area. My background is special education and law, and I've worked for over the last decade in bullying prevention. I wrote the first book ever published on cyberbullying and cyber threats. It was published by Research Press in 2007. For about the last 5 years, I've been really focusing my research on what's not working in bullying prevention, why it's not working, and how we can improve. And I am totally in favor of greater efforts to address bullying. Representative Daugherty and Power and I, the Basic Rights Oregon folks, I really appreciate their leadership. I do not believe this legislation will do anything really all that effective in reducing bullying, and that's what concerns me. So I'd like to explain why and how you might be able to improve. Okay? First of all, the legislative language fails to effectively address cyberbullying. Secondly, the complaint process language is really sort of nebulous, Representative Vile. It's like, you know, what's going to happen when these complaints are filed, and so I think that could be tightened. Third, the reporting process is not all that effective in reducing bullying. So I'm going to start off. 29.9% of Oregon's eighth graders reported that they had been repeatedly bullied in the 1 month prior to the Oregon Health survey. This is an underrating because they list the categories where you bullied based on, and they left out disabilities. Kids with disabilities are frequently bullied. The bullying prevention statutes that have been enacted over the last decade do not appear to be having any positive impact. If you look at the Youth Risk Behavior Survey data from the Center for Disease Control, the rate at which students report being bullied has not declined since 2009, when they first started collecting that data. We can't track data here in Oregon because the Oregon Health Division changed the definition and the question for the 2015 survey, and I would anticipate the rate's going to go up in the 2017. The problem that we're one of the biggest problems is we've turned this into a disciplinary code issue. And what's required is that schools really thoroughly address the hostile environment. When you set things up in a disciplinary code manner, what has happened is that you give the students who are engaging in bullying greater protective rights than those who are being bullied. It's very difficult for a student in a protected class to bring a case for discriminatory harassment. It is impossible for a student who's not in a protected class to get any legal protection for bullying. A student can relatively easily sue a school district for violation of due process. So by only approaching this from a disciplinary code perspective, what you're doing is you're setting up the principles so if they don't have absolutely clear evidence that this occurred, if it's a he said, she said, they're not going to label this as bullying. The second challenge is that you have the opportunity to help Oregon school districts by more effectively addressing the issue of cyberbullying. Your language does not, the Oregon statute does nothing to help address cyberbullying. You put cyberbullying in there that occurs on school campus. That's not where cyberbullying occurs, okay? The case law is very clear. School officials have the legal authority to respond to instances of off-campus speech if that speech has caused or foreseeably could cause a significant interference with the ability of another student to receive an education. So if the hurtful acts meet the definition under 339.351, the school official does have the authority to intervene. Now, I'll send you a link to the law review article that I published on that, and I could propose some language, and many of the other states have actually added that language to their statute. That then makes it clear that what we have now is a kid comes in and says, I'm being cyberbullied, and frequently the response is off campus, can't do anything. Well, if you say off campus, can't do anything, you're not giving that child any avenue to resolve that issue, except perhaps for school violence. So we need to get that added. The complaint process, I just think the language is, could be, it would be helpful to have that narrowed down. Only about a third of students who are bullied report to the school. Only about a third. I have a study that I did. I'll send you the data. And there's another study that some other researchers did, and they asked what happened after the student reported. And both of us, we did the studies in two different ways. About a third of the time, things got better. A third of the time, things stayed the same, and a third of the time, things got worse. So the current level of effectiveness of the, you have a rule, tell the school, and the school will investigate and intervene, is about 10%. So you could, you can do all the reporting you want, but you're only going to get a third of this. So my, my recommendation. My recommendation is, the person who seems to be providing. Oh, also, Oregon Department of Education, bullying prevention is not a priority. Do a search for bullying on their site. I was told by the staff it's not a priority. The agency that seems to be very interested in this is the Chief of Education Office, Colt Gill. He's focusing on chronic absences and dropouts, and he knows that bullying is a key factor in that. I would suggest additional language that places some tasks for the Chief of Education Office in addition to bullying, in addition to the reporting, which can help. What we need is a survey. We need better data. We need to know much better data than the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey. We need to know how many kids are being bullied, how serious that is, how effective school is responding, whether or not they're reporting. And we also need to address issues of whether or not school staff are the source of bullying. Turns out that's a huge factor. So my recommendation would be to add some language to this legislation that would provide the ability to both track reports as well as the survey data. And I would suggest to you that that is actually what the military is doing to address sexual assault. If they're just going, what they want is the level of reports to go up and the survey level of incident rates to go down.
Okay,
that's
fine.
What I would suggest. So I'd be happy to take
questions.
Thank
you very much. Do we have any questions of the panelists? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. That's the only people we had signed up. So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2649. And anything else for the good of the order? I think that's it. Okay, with that, the House Committee on Education is adjourned. That's it. Okay, with that, the House Committee on Education is adjourned.